I saw a little video online the other day. The video was produced by the AARP, the American Association for Retired People. So the video featured a story about an older guy. The video began, he was about to retire, and then he found a secret that might save the planet. Well, that's a little exaggerated, but here's what he did discover. The guy is some kind of a marine biologist. I'm a little unclear on the details, but it's not really relevant for the point I need to make. The guy discovered that if you break apart a living coral, that the separate pieces will grow. He said he broke the coral by accident. After the accident, his expectation was that the broken pieces would be stressed and they would die. Instead, he put the broken pieces into an ocean-like environment in his lab, cared for them, and was surprised to see that the broken pieces more than survived, they flourished. They actually grew even faster than normal. Now, I'm a little surprised that people didn't already know this about coral, so undoubtedly I'm missing something, but again, it's not relevant. I'm getting to my point eventually. So apparently the guy had discovered that there's some sort of super growth gene response to stress, a finding that has implications for cancer research for one thing. But being a marine scientist and a diver, the guy also realized that his discovery was a way to help reestablish coral in places where coral had died off due to rising water temperatures and increased acidity in the oceans due to climate change. Coral die-off is a huge threat to the health of our oceans and thus the future of life on our planet. This guy found funding somewhere, and again, I'm unclear, and again, not relevant, and he set up a coral growing lab, like a very big greenhouse for the coral, with the intention of restocking reefs where the ocean coral had died. Now, here's where a problem occurred to me as I was watching this little video. I said, wait a second. If you raise the coral in your lab, which is like this huge greenhouse, and then you introduce the coral back into the ocean, but the ocean still has the same increased temperature and acidity that's killing the coral in the first place, then isn't your new coral just going to die the same as the old coral did? You haven't really solved anything. And then, almost as soon as that question occurred to me, the video answered my objection. The lab environment that the scientist created to raise his coral is not the ideal growing environment. He set the water temperature and acidity levels to mirror the real environment of the current oceans. And furthermore, and here's my point finally, the guy has created growing environments that mimic the even more hostile environments that are likely to come in future oceans as global temperatures continue to rise. He's watching which of his coral genetic lines are the most suitable for future oceans. And he's propagating and reintroducing those corals that have the best chance of surviving decades in the future. In other words, this old guy about to retire, says the AARP, is doing future work. He's imagining future problems, and he's working out future solutions. Toward the end of his own lifetime, he's asking what the world will look like in the future. And he's asking, what do we need to do now in order to make the future more livable for coral and for all living things that depend on healthy oceans? As W.E.B. Du Bois said in a very different context, it is today that we fit ourselves for the greater usefulness of tomorrow, even for a tomorrow that we may never see ourselves. We who care about the future of churches must ask ourselves the same question. Not only what should we do to solve the problems of the church today, but what can we do today to solve the problems that the church will face in the future? In any rapidly changing environment, work to solve present problems is pretty useless, because by the time you've got the solution, the situation will have already changed. Either the problem will have resolved itself and you didn't really need to do the work anyway, or the problem will have done its damage irreversibly and you'll be too late. I think the church today is facing that kind of rapidly changing environment. If we will live up to our responsibility to be good stewards of this faith, we can't work to solve today's problems. We'll be too late. The solutions will no longer be relevant once we implement them. If it takes a couple of years to create a solution, we have to work on the problem that will exist a couple of years from now. If it takes a couple of decades to create the solution, then we have to start now creating solutions for the problems that will exist a couple of decades from now. But of course, as I often like to say in the first part of a sermon, the problem is much worse than that. Because our churches are already decades behind. Our churches today are not really struggling even with the problems of 2020. Our churches are still struggling with the problems of 2010 or 1970 or 1950. Video technology is not new, but most of our churches don't use it. Our churches don't regularly project images, which is fairly easy to do. Our sound systems are not up to date, nor are we using the latest technology for hearing assistance. We're not solving tomorrow's problems. We're barely keeping up with today's problems. Our gray hymnal, which I love, is 35 years old, and the hymns in it are decades, even centuries older than that. And that doesn't mean we should throw them out, but it requires us to ask the question, where will new music come from? And how do we regularly include new music in worship? Does singing the decades-old hymns in our decades-old hymnal help people with the problems they have today or that they will be having 20 or 30 years from now? We're still following old, old forms of worship. A sermon that's far too long for today's attention spans, and mine will go long. I'm stuck in it just like you are. Worship that depends on sitting quietly and listening rather than responding or seeing images or moving around. Theologically, we're still having the same tiresome debates between theism and atheism. We're still passing baskets to receive the collection when there are apps for that. We're still putting up bulletin boards for communication. We're still worshiping in a physical space at a specific time. And if you're not in the room when it happens, well, you miss out. Meanwhile, have you heard of a thing called the internet? Smartphones, apps, Zoom rooms, PayPal. Forget PayPal. Have you heard of credit cards? Meetup groups, Instagram, WhatsApp, TikTok, live streaming. Have you heard about the rising number of folks who call themselves spiritual but not religious? The nuns who crave spiritual experiences but aren't really that interested in sitting for an hour in a folding chair listening to a lecture about humanism. People still crave what churches offer, but the structure that we've created to present our spiritual product hasn't kept up with the way people access the spiritual today. We expect people to come to us during the hours that we're open and buy what we stock on our shelf. We are seers in an age of Amazon. So to be a faith that survives into the future, we have to know two things. What is the need that people have and will still have 30 years from now that churches can fulfill better than other organizations? And the second question is, how do we offer our product, our solution, our service to that need in a way that people expect to get their needs met in today's world and will expect to get them met in the future? So the first question is, what is the human need that churches fulfill, that only churches fulfill, or that we fulfill better than anyone else? In the 1950s, in the 1950s model that most of our churches still follow, churches offered a lot of things that people could not get elsewhere. You came to church for community, for fellowship and friends. You came to make connections in the community that would be helpful to your career. You came to give a moral education to your children and reminders and encouragement for yourself. You came to church to hear interesting thinking and to hear beautiful music. You came for inspiration and hope and courage. You came to get activated on the political issues of the day and organized to do meaningful work on those issues. You came because the church had a missionary arm that was doing good work for needy people around the world. You came for help and healing about the fears and anxieties of life, like depression and loneliness, spiritual questions of identity and meaning and purpose. You came for counseling about problems with your marriage or help with a moral dilemma, or you had a question about God. You came to church craving connection to something larger than yourself and to feel hope and promise for a better future. And we still offer all of that. But a lot of other organizations offer many of those same things now. And some of them do it better than we do. And a lot of them do it more conveniently than we do. If I want to hear an interesting speaker talk about an important question of the day, I don't go to church. I go to YouTube. I find a TED Talk. Or I subscribe to someone's podcast. I don't need to wait for months and then drive across town in order to be in a particular place at a particular time to hear a talk from a person that I'm interested in. And I don't need to belong to a church or pay a pledge to hear a talk. The talk is right in front of me on my laptop, wherever I am and whenever I want it. Occasionally, if it's someone really special, I will go to a live talk. The Los Angeles Central Library, for instance, has a speaker series that my husband and I go to occasionally. And a library is a good place to hear an interview with a secular person who's on a book tour, not a church. If I want to get involved in a social justice movement, I'm going to join an issue-specific political organization, not a church. I like that our churches are involved in issues like climate change. But if I'm really interested in climate change, if that's my motivation, why would I join a church when I could just join the Citizens Climate Lobby? The Women's March was organized on Facebook, not in a fellowship hall. And I get my political news from the Washington Post and the New York Times, not from a minister who's reading the same things that I can read for myself. And I get my political theory from blogs and from nonfiction books, not from the pulpit. If I needed marriage counseling, I'd go to a therapist, not a pastor. And I do get better theater and music and as much of it as I want from arts organizations, and so on. So what do churches offer uniquely or significantly better than other organizations? Well, there are three things, I believe, that are really the church's business. Three important things. Three things that should be the work of the church. And they're interrelated. Community, spirituality, and relationship with the theological tradition. The first answer is community. Social media and Starbucks claim to create communities, but they don't. And neither do folks create real communities through a collection of yoga classes and ad hoc activism and friends from work. I go to the library speaker series or the theater, and I sit next to strangers who I'll never see again. Creating community connections is a real problem for our contemporary culture. People need community. We crave community. And we always will, because we are social animals. And we need the kinds of communities that churches offer: committed, intimate, comforting, and challenging. And churches offer a special type of community. We are a spiritual community. We don't gather just for entertainment or lectures or politics, which you can get elsewhere. Nor do we gather just for the kinds of practical help that you can get better through a social service agency or a therapist's office. We offer those kinds of services, but our unique value is engaging in those activities from a spiritual perspective and for a spiritual purpose. A church offers a community focused uniquely on spiritual questions of identity and meaning and purpose. And because our church is grounded in a particular Unitarian and Universalist theology and tradition, we belong to a larger spiritual community that extends through time, a spiritual tradition of freedom and reason and tolerance, transcendence, humanism, that calls you back again and again to deeper reflection and transformation, not the constant call of the next spiritual fad and the new pop guru of the day. Church sermons talk about a wide range of subjects, but with the common thread, of exploring the spiritual dimension of life. And unlike a TED Talk or a podcast or a one-off speaker at the library, our churches offer, through the pastor, a living relationship with a trained theologian and a religious tradition. Sermons might have the form of a lecture, but they aren't lectures. Sermons are preached for a particular community at a particular time. Sermons are created for you by someone who knows a theological tradition generally, and a congregation specifically. The guest speaker on their book tour knows their book, but they don't know you. And when tonight's gig at the library is finished, they will fly off to Seattle to give the same talk. But you go to church to have an extended theological dialogue with an ongoing religious tradition, week after week. So, yes, churches do offer worship, education, fellowship and fun, pastoral care, work for social justice, but those are really just the media of our work. What we really offer, uniquely and well, is covenanted community focused on spiritual questions and an ongoing relationship with a theological tradition. So what then of the second question? The first is, what products do churches offer better than other organizations? And I believe the answer is covenanted community focused on spiritual questions and in relationship with a theological tradition. The second question is, how do we offer those products in a way that people are able to receive them in the culture of today and in the way that our culture is evolving into the future? That's hard to know. Here's what I do know. To be a community, people need to gather. Virtual communities through the internet don't work. But neither does a community gathering require a purpose-built church building. People can gather in rented space, like here, or they can gather in a living room, or a restaurant, or a park. The emerging culture demands that we bring our product to the people the way the internet does. A single big church building like that department store across town that you have to get yourself to during opening hours isn't going to cut it anymore. And neither does the community need to be large. A smaller community that can come to you or closer to you is probably better. And a smaller community is also better for creating intimacy and relationships, which we all value. I'm not saying our churches have to be small, but there's nothing wrong with them being small. And if we do have large congregations, to do some of the things that large congregations can do well, like a robust religious education program for children or a big music program, the large congregation will also need to find ways to divide itself into the smaller and more intimate and geographically distributed communities that I believe the future will need. Keeping the community focused on spirituality and having an ongoing relationship with a theological tradition requires the leadership of an educated clergy person. Hiring a minister costs money, and money will get tight as congregations get small. And meanwhile, paying for seminary educations will get more expensive. But dispensing with purpose-built church buildings and shifting to electronic forms of communication and connections whenever possible will save a ton of money. There's no furniture, there's no maintenance, there's no insurance. And if our church communities are tightly focused on spiritual issues, perhaps a single professional spiritual leader could be shared by several small communities who don't also need that clergy person to be the church administrator and the broad generalist that we expect them to be now. For examples of the kind of future church that I'm imagining, ironically, we can look to the past. The early Christian churches were organized as home churches, small communities meeting in members' homes. Worship created by individuals sharing their gifts and centered around a shared meal. And a professional clergy person shared among several such communities. Think of Paul leading a dozen different communities that he stayed in touch with through writing letters while he traveled around the Mediterranean. Think of churches in 19th century rural America that were shared by a circuit rider preacher. So is this the future of our churches? Well, who knows? But I do know that holding on in 2020 to a church model that served the needs of the church of 1950 is a mistake. The world has changed, and our churches must change too. Even if we can't be certain of the direction, we need to take the risk. And by 2050, our world and our churches will change again. Will we be ready? Wake now, my reason, reach out to the new. Wake now, my vision of ministry clear. With heart and mind and voice and hand, may we this time and place transcend. Will we be ready? Or will we watch with regret as the churches that we love, the faith we love, passes away like coral in a warming sea? And not before we retire, try one more experiment, benefit perhaps from a happy accident, to see if maybe, just maybe, there's a new way toward amazing vitality that we hadn't known before. Prophetic Church, the future waits your liberating ministry. Thank you.